When it comes to life and evolution, I have several questions. One of those is, what is life? Now, I've got several podcasts and videos about this answer. You know, what is something living? What makes something living? The answer is, I thought I knew. I still kind of know. But I've learned some things that have, I need to incorporate into my new view of life. And then secondly, life and evolution. Is the origin of life in the universe, is that deterministic? Or is it at least favorable? And not only that, let's take this one step or several steps further. Not only do I wonder if the evolution of life is deterministic, or like I said, you know, at least favorable, what about the evolution of complexity in the universe? What about the evolution of things like plants, animals, complex ecosystems? What about the evolution of intelligence, advanced societies, technologically advanced societies? Are these actually favored in the universe? All right, today's episode of Tom SciCast, we are going to definitely push some boundaries here, because I know that I've had some of my boundaries pushed of how I thought about evolution and life and determinism or favorable states. So let's push those boundaries today. Let's go to the edge of what we know and maybe even look over that edge. But as always, we're going to stay grounded in science. I'll start with an age-old question. What is life? And if you've listened to some of my earlier work, I don't really like the question, what is life? Because I think that it's very important how we ask the question as to how we get to the answer. So if you're asking what is life, you might get a textbook definition, a list of 5 or 7 characteristics about life. You know, life uses energy, has metabolism, reproduces, evolves, moves or responds to the environment. Those are things that life definitely does, and we can think of those as actions. And so other ways to think about life is not only is life an action, but we can start to think about life in terms of our different fields. If you're a biologist, life reproduces and evolves. If you're a geologist, life is an extension of geological processes. You know, at some point, geochemistry becomes biochemistry, but we are an extension of the Earth. If you're a physicist, you might think of life as a system that's out of equilibrium with its environment, a non-equilibrium system that is using energy to create order. So you could also think of life as this little island of low entropy surrounded by a sea of chaos. So you start to get the idea that there are different ways of thinking about life. For a long time, well, at least since I started thinking about origins of life, I really took this view of life is an action. Life is a verb. Life does something. And what life, in my traditional view, has always done, life extracts energy from the environment, and it uses that energy to create order. And it does this through metabolism directed by its DNA. So you get the idea here. Energy is flowing through life. There are these open systems, and through these complex chemical reactions, life is creating order. And then, of course, for there to be a continuity of life, life has to be able to reproduce. And reproduction in life is taking the information in life, copying it, and making a new organism, which ensures this continuity of life. So, for example, you are the end result of 3.8 billion years of an unbroken lineage. And I've said this before, your great, 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 insert several billions of greats in there, grandparent was some bacteria swimming in the ocean billions of years ago. And there's a few other things about life that are also important. Life is an emergent property of a complex system. And in fact, the NASA definition of life that we can use when we're looking elsewhere in the universe, NASA defines life as a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. I've always liked this definition. It's one sentence, and it says a lot. It's self-sustaining. There's probably some copying of information, because it's also capable of evolving by natural selection. That's Darwinian evolution. And it calls it a chemical system. And systems are surrounded by some type of barrier, and that system is a set of interconnecting parts that are operating together. So this sets up a couple other things, right? Life is an emergent property of a complex system. An emergent property basically means you're greater than the sum of your parts. So even though I can take a reductionist view to understanding life, I can look at the flows of energy, I can look at the information stored in the DNA, how that information flows to making proteins. But the emergent properties of life aren't so much the properties of all the building blocks of life, but more about the interactions that occur from those building blocks. So as you start to see, it's hard to define life, isn't it? It's hard to get that one sentence definition of life that everybody agrees on. I mean, NASA comes close. And I've always kind of gone along with NASA and always kind of realized that life is an emergent property of this complex system. Starting last fall, I've been thinking about this definition of life a little bit more. And it began when I started teaching my class on astrobiology. I went in thinking I had a pretty good handle of life, of how we could search the universe, and if we saw it, we'd probably be able to recognize it. And I still believe that now. But I decided to write a book on astrobiology, which I'm working on now. And as you can imagine, as I've dived into the literature, I've gone down several rabbit holes, and one of those rabbit holes has led me to think about life in a very different way. And this is from the viewpoint of some theoretical physicists. I know, theoretical physicists defining life? What in the world? How does that work? Well, some of them are from ASU and the Santa Fe Institute. One was Sarah Walker. And if I stumble over this, it's because I still haven't quite wrapped my head around it, and I'm doing a podcast to work my way through these ideas and maybe get some feedback from you guys to if I'm way off the mark here or if I'm on the right track. But think about this. A few months ago, if you asked me, hey, Tom, you know, you said life is an emergent property. Well, what is that emergent property? Somebody asked me this and I was like, complexity. And let me go even further back to the beginning of the semester when I was talking to one of my colleagues, Kelly Miller, about what life is or how we define life. And his definition involved information and the propagation of information. At first, I admit, I didn't really like that definition. I preferred my convoluted, you know, life is an action, life is a verb, it's using energy to create order, you know, through metabolism directed by DNA. I know. But I didn't really get the importance of that information. I knew it was important for life because life's activities are directed by information. But in this kind of new view that I've gotten as I've gone down this rabbit hole, and it goes back to this abiogenesis and the transition from geochemistry to biochemistry. What makes something a bunch of fancy chemical reactions versus something that's living? I think I'm one step closer to maybe understanding this, and it does involve information. I think the transition is something when information begins to take control of your system. Now remember, a system is a set of all these interconnecting parts or interdependent parts surrounded by some barrier. And in cells, that barrier is likely the membrane. Information taking control. Think about it. Our cells are controlled by our DNA. Every aspect of metabolism is controlled by DNA. That also allows cells to extract energy and resources from the environment. That information also allows cells to maintain homeostasis. It also allows cells to react to the environment. And of course, when you copy that information, you make a new organism because you're copying the information. So that information is very important for maintaining life because that information is what is in control. Let me just scale up really big to like a human. We are made of trillions of cells, each cell an independent living unit, and our bodies, our cells, all work together for the greater good. But here's something that's interesting. There is hardly a protein in my body that was there several years ago. There's hardly anything in my body that was here several years ago. Oh yeah, certainly there's still some DNA and other things still around, but the vast majority of the proteins, molecules, elements, have all passed through me. It's like the old saying, you never jump in the same river twice. Because even though the river is there, the water molecules are all different. I'm still here. I still have all my memories. I still have the same genes. But me 20 years ago, there's hardly a molecule in me that's the same. And the reason why is because the information is maintaining me. It's maintaining my life. It's maintaining my cells and all these different actions that life has to, that I have to carry out to be alive. Information is in control. I hope I don't sound too much like I'm arm waving. I am still trying to wrap my brain around this. So now when I think about life, something that's living, I think all of these parts that I said are still important, but it's the information. It's not just that information is being propagated and evolves, it's that the information is in control of the system. It's a new way of thinking about it. For some of you, this may be old hat, but for me, I just kind of really put the connections here together, and it's been quite the ride. Because now I have an idea of that transition between geochemistry and biochemistry. The geochemistry can be lots of chemical reactions, building up organic molecules. But that transition from geochemistry to biochemistry, the transition from an abiotic system to a biotic system, is when information takes control. Now, that being said, I have no idea how that happened. And listening to some of the theoretical physicists, you know, coming up with this idea of information and the importance of information for life, I still think we need to use a lot of what Nick Lane, Mike Russell, and Bill Martin and their views of abiogenesis, because they're the ones that are really looking at like the characteristics of all living things and applying those commonalities, what they all share in common, like, you know, chemiosmosis, electron transport, some basic chemical pathways like the Krebs cycle, the reverse Krebs cycle, how these common features of life informed us about the origins of life in those first cells. So I still think very much that life began as an extension of geology in thermal hot vents, almost certainly in the alkaline vents, where you had these, you know, alkaline conditions in the vent going through into an acidic ocean, which created these natural chemical reactors. And I think that is still the birthplace of life. And I still am very much that life is an action. We can look at those actions to understand our origins. But now I have a much better idea of the transition from non-living to living. Now, here's some other things that I have been thinking about, and it's really challenging my views on how I learned evolution and how I was trained to think about evolution. And this has to do with some of the complexity. Once again, I'm going to try not to stumble through it because I'm still honestly working this out for myself. For the last, I don't know, decade, two decades, probably my whole life, actually, I've been loosely following the field of astrobiology. One of the most interesting observations I have about the field is that much of it has come from astronomers, with the help of some microbiologists. So astrophysicists, planetary geologists, cosmologists, they've been the ones really advancing the field. Surprisingly, in the field of biology, astrobiology, there's been few biologists. So as a biologist, I thought I could bring my lens to this field. I have to admit, it's been interesting reading what physicists and astronomers and even microbiologists have brought to the field of astrobiology. I've learned a lot. I've pushed my horizons a little bit, but at the same time, being trained as a biologist, well, it gives me the lens through which I look through the world. And one of those is the paradigm of evolution by natural selection. And one of the most important concepts about evolution is that it's not goal-oriented. Evolution is not trying to evolve to some point over there. It's not trying to evolve to get to a more complex organism. It's not trying to evolve to a human. Does that make sense? Evolution doesn't have any goals. It's being driven by natural selection and sexual selection too. So what's happening is that if you have a population and there's variation in that population, the individuals that have some combination of alleles, or genes, so to speak, the ones that have the best combination are more likely to survive and reproduce and pass on those genes to the next generation. So over time, you accumulate favorable traits in the environment. So evolution by natural selection is reactionary. It's about improving your fitness. So like I said, no goal other than you're reacting to, like, if you improve your fitness, good job, you win. And then in the 1990s, I read some Stephen Jay Gould. He was, you know, very popular back in the 1990s, and he was pretty much against evolution being progressive. And in fact, that's another thing, because if we imply that evolution is progressive, that means you have higher and lower organisms. So for example, even when I was at Florida State, we had higher and lower vertebrates. Higher vertebrates were, of course, birds and mammals, and the lower vertebrates were fish and amphibians. I don't know where that puts reptiles. Probably down there with amphibians, even though birds are well nested within the reptiles, right? But either way, by assigning the category of higher and lower vertebrates, there's an implication that evolution is progressive, going from primitive to advanced. And believe it or not, I actually have some things to say about that. But returning to higher and lower vertebrates, once again, this implies that evolution is progressive, that it's progressing toward something more advanced. Another way of saying that is complexity. So back in the 1990s, when I was in biology and first learning my theories of biology and my philosophy of biology as well, you know, Gould had a big influence, and he said, you know, yeah, there's some organisms like animals that are more complex than bacteria. And he backed up this idea that the Earth is not really becoming complexity because we're biased. We're biased toward the things that we can see, plants and animals, and those ecosystems that are comprised of plants and animals. And he would point out that the vast majority of life on this planet remained microbial, bacteria, archaeans, prokaryotes, which are much less complex than the eukaryotes, which form plants and animals. Of course, I learned this during some very formative years, you know, my 20s, when, back in the 1990s when I was learning biology. And those ideas have stuck with me for a long time. Although there's always been this nagging sense that maybe evolution is progressive. Maybe there are really higher and lower animals. And one of the responses that most evolutionary biologists would say to you is that, well, a horseshoe crab might physically look the same as it did 450 million years ago, but if you looked under the hood, if you looked at its physiology, it's changed. You know what? I doubt that. I doubt it's changed much. What's probably have changed is its ability to respond to new pathogens and parasites and diseases in its environment, but from the cell level all the way up to its morphology, it has basically operated the same ever since. I mean, what about it is actually changing? And this arm-waving explanation that, well, they've been evolving, you just don't see it because you're not looking at the physiology. Yeah, I doubt that. There's something called stabilizing selection, which you know, if you evolve to be anything different, you're quickly removed from the population. Okay, well, I'm starting to digress here a little bit. The point is I am starting to think that the evolution of life on Earth is progressive. It's not goal-oriented, but it is progressive. The world is evolving to be more complex, definitely. And I don't think that's a bias either. When I looked up some references on the biomass of the Earth, approximately half the biomass is prokaryotes, the other half are eukaryotes, with most of the prokaryotic biomass being underground. Okay, so I've heard this before, you know, that microbes rule the world, and you could remove all the eukaryotes and the microbes would continue on just fine. I disagree with that. Microbes definitely would continue on, without a doubt. However, think about microbial diversity is utterly dependent on eukaryotic diversity. You and me, we have, you know, about a trillion to, you know, several trillions of bacteria living in and on us, forming our microbiomes. Each one of us has around 1,000 different types of microbes living in our gut. 1,000. That's a lot of diversity. And it turns out that, like, every animal's gut, or every animal has a microbiome. Every plant has a microbiome. Even the microbial communities in the soil are largely, they're decomposers, and they're breaking down organic material made by, wait for it, plants and animals. So if you did remove the eukaryotes, the prokaryotic communities would be instantaneously simplified. So even microbial biomass and diversity is dependent on eukaryotes. Now, I will admit that eukaryotic diversity is almost certainly dependent on prokaryotic diversity as well, especially when it comes to key evolutionary innovations like photosynthesis and cellular respiration. So I basically kind of reject this idea that the world of complexity as we see it, that we're biased because we see plants and animals. I don't believe that at all. I do think that the world is very complex. And I think that evolution has led to complexity in a progressive kind of way. Not goal-oriented. I want to be very clear here. Now, the reason why I think that evolution is progressive is because it's favored. It's pushed that way. It's not just a random drunkard's walk, like Gould would say. However, I do agree that if you ran the clock backward again, you'll get different species, different ecosystems, different interactions and relationships. I have no problem with that at all. But I do believe that if you go back in the Earth history and reset the clock, you would once again evolve complexity. It's progressive. Here's why. And this came from the physicist. And I love reading about astrobiology from physicists because I can also gain insight from that. And a physicist named Andrew May said, you know, everything in the universe happens because of energy flow. Think about that. Everything in the universe happens because of energy flow. And energy is flowing so it can reach equilibrium and speed up entropy so the universe can have its heat death. Any phenomena that favors using energy or more energy or using energy faster is thermodynamically favored because, as we know from the laws of thermodynamics, that every time you use energy, you increase entropy. Energy becomes less usable, but importantly, it brings about equilibrium. The universe wants to be in equilibrium. It wants to have high entropy. I'm not talking about a sentient rate, but that's the laws of nature, right? As laws of nature, as far as we know it, the laws of thermodynamics govern energy, and energy is just a part of life. I mean, you can't have life without energy. So if you start thinking about life in terms of energy, going back to what does life do, and one of the first things that I said is life uses energy to create order. Order at the level of the system, which is life. Now, life, from a cell all the way up to you to even an ecosystem, these living systems require a constant flow of energy through them, and they use that energy you know, to basically create order through metabolism directed by information. Information's making these things happen, right? But because life is using energy, it's increasing the total entropy in the universe. So the logical consequence of this is abiogenesis, the origins of life, is thermodynamically favored because life speeds up entropy in the universe as a whole, right? I mean, think about that. Life is thermodynamically favored. Now, this makes me really happy because that would imply that life could be abundant in the universe. Now, there could be a filter that you need the exact right conditions for life to occur. But even so, it's at least thermodynamically favored because it speeds up entropy. Now, I've already said this, but let's take this further. I used to think about these evolutionary innovations that led to our modern world. I got this from Nick Lane's Life Ascending, you know, the 10 Great Inventions of Evolution. Really revolutionized the way I think about biology and evolution. But now, thinking about it from the aspect of thermodynamics, many of those key evolutionary innovations paved the way for additional key evolutionary innovations, paved the way for life to be more complex because you could use more energy. Think about this. The very first living organisms on this planet were autotrophic. They were residing in these thermal vents. Their source of energy was basically reacting hydrogen gas to carbon dioxide using some metal ion. As you can imagine, you're not going to get very complex ecosystems, and you're not going to have a lot of diversity in biomass. So eventually, you know, life evolved heterotrophy. You could have some things eating these other autotrophs. But because there's not a lot of production, not a lot of energy available, these systems and life itself kind of stagnated in complexity. Then photosynthesis evolved. Photosynthesis, as you know, I mean, it takes energy from sunlight, takes some water and carbon dioxide, releases oxygen, and now you have much more energy available to your ecosystems. You also have more carbon available to your ecosystems. With more energy, more resources, life can become more complex. But there's still a barrier here. And that is, well, it's efficiency. Because you're still not using oxygen to make ATP here, you're not doing aerobic respiration, you're still limited in the amount of energy you can have, but you're still a larger biomass, more diversity, more complex system with the evolution of photosynthesis. And of course, it released oxygen into the atmosphere, so you know what happens next. Next key evolutionary innovation, aerobic or cellular respiration. And cellular respiration, this is where you use oxygen to help get a lot more work done out of your organic molecules. You can make a lot more ATP. Oxygen energizes life because it makes life much more efficient at extracting energy from the energy stored in our food. Okay, now we have more energy available to life. And of course, once we got aerobic or cellular respiration, the next big step toward complexity was eukaryogenesis. The origins of eukaryotic cells through, or endosymbiosis, I should say, where an aerobically respiring bacteria started to live inside of another cell, probably an archaean or something. Now, you can internalize your energy production in something called a mitochondria rather than doing it across your cellular membrane. Enormous benefit. Because as your cells grow larger and more complex, you need more energy. The way you get more energy is you add more mitochondria to your cells. So for the first time in 2 billion years, with the evolution of eukaryotes, we see this major restructuring of cells as they become larger and more complex. And with more energy and more complexity, life diversified again. Then sometime around 1 billion years ago, give or take, this is, you know, still debated here, we start to see the origins of multicellular life, plants, or at least the ancestors to plants. Oh my gosh, here we go. Once again, adding complexity. With the origins of multicellular ancestral plants, well, guess what? Now you're creating habitat. You're creating habitat complexity. But because you're photosynthetic, you're making more energy and more nutrients available to your ecosystems along with habitat complexity. And guess what evolved right around that time or shortly thereafter? Animals, another multicellular organism. And it's favored because animals use more energy than a single-celled eukaryote. So once again, we're ratcheting up in complexity. That ratcheting up of complexity is driven by the ability to use more energy, which speeds up entropy in the entire universe. This is thermodynamically favored. And then for the last 550 million years, we have seen ecosystems and the diversity of life continually become more and more complex as we get more species, more diversity, more interactions. Jump ahead to 400 million years ago, and by that time, plants had largely colonized the surface of the planet. And we have our first forest, and more oxygen, more diversity, more complexity. This is progressive, not goal-oriented, but it is a favored state because it speeds up the rate that you use energy. To me, this was just earth-shattering to think about this. Then as our ecosystems become more complex with more interactions, more diversity, they can also become less stable. Think about a coral reef or a rainforest. These are the most diverse regions in the world. Where do you find them? In the tropics, where you have the most energy, but you also have to have your resources available too, right? Without the resources, if you could have all the energy in the world, if you don't have water or certain macronutrients, you're not going to be diverse, but if you have all those ingredients, you will be, and it's the amount of energy that allows these ecosystems to be much more diverse. And in fact, net primary productivity, which is like the amount of carbon that plants will sequester, you know, per square area over every year, whatever your unit of time is, net primary productivity is a function of energy, and it's also really important for driving diversity. Now let's jump ahead even more. Let's think about humans in our society. Humans evolved as hunter-gatherers. Then we evolved some simple tools and then the ability to grow our own food. Once again, that made more energy and nutrients available to our populations. What did our populations do? They exploded. And not only that, here's some new ideas I've been thinking about. I mean, I didn't develop these ideas. They came from like Santa Fe Institute and others thinking about complexity. I never gave it much thought, but the evolution of our societies is also driven by energy availability. The first complex societies, you know, lots of people, lots of different interactions, trade routes, people farming, growing, politicians, teachers, philosophers, is all made possible because we had more energy available to us. So the human population in our societies grew with the advent of the agricultural revolution. Then you go back, you know, several hundred years and we get the industrial revolution. This was fueled by a couple of things. One of them was changes in technology, but those changes in technology allowed us to harness, wait for it, another source of energy. Fossil fuels. And for the most part, fossil fuels are fairly abundant, really cheap. And that once again fueled another boom in our society, both in the complexity of the number of people we have and also in its technology. Think about how complex our society is, all the different moving parts, which could be scary. I'm not sure if it is or not. I don't know. But complex systems are often like a house of cards, a small perturbation, doesn't take much, and they can all come crashing down to a much more simple system. I don't know if that will happen to our society. I don't know if we're resilient because humans are smart and can figure things out, or if it doesn't take much for our entire system to collapse. But the point is, even the advent of our technologically advanced society, I know, we're technologically advanced. We might pale in comparison to aliens higher up on the Kardashev scale that have been around for millions of years, but we are technologically advanced. And if you think about it from this point of view of energy, entropy, because we're using energy faster and faster and faster, that maybe is our society also thermodynamically favored? Is progress, I don't want to use the word deterministic, because that means it's going to happen, but I would use the term favored. So if I extrapolate this out into the universe, what does that mean for alien life? Is life in itself abundant? What does that say about the prevalence of technologically advanced civilizations? I don't know. And I can sit here and tell you that based on my line of reasoning from what I've learned here recently, that, well, it's favored thermodynamically, which favors it to happen. But then I start to wonder about things like, well, is each step along the way that we had from the origins of life, the evolution of photosynthesis, the evolution of cellular respiration, the evolution of multicellularity, the evolution of moving on to land, the evolution of intelligence capable of using tools, you know, the agricultural revolution, the availability of fossil fuels to push forward another technological revolution, you know, are each one of these filters or barriers to life progressing to become more and more and more complex? Even if it's thermodynamically favored, it might not be able to get over the hump because one of those key events might form the barrier. And in fact, I often wonder, like, are there, you know, advanced civilizations out there spanning the entire galaxy? You know, back in 1950, Enrico Fermi goes, "Where is everybody?" It's become known as a Fermi's paradox, right? And I'll do some more discussions on that later. But there's people out there that say, well, you know, we must be it because we haven't come across other intelligent beings. Maybe. So maybe those steps along the way in our progress, I know that goes against everything I was taught. The steps on our way to the progress of society, those may be the actual filters. But like I'll say once again, it's thermodynamically favored. And this notion that evolutionary progress is thermodynamically favored really goes against the idea that evolution is blind. I know it's not goal-oriented, but maybe it is progress driven by these natural laws, by the laws of thermodynamics. So it's not a true drunkard's walk. So the idea here is if you did restart evolution all over again, you may or may not get humans in our advanced civilizations. You might get it a lot earlier. It might come again a lot later, or it just may never happen because there's an improbable set of events, even favored, but didn't lead to the evolution of humans. But what I would say is that on our planet, at least, complexity would still arise. You would get lots of diversity forming complex ecosystems. The tropics would be more diverse than the poles, mostly because of energy. So these are some of the ideas I've been kicking around lately with astrobiology, origins of life, whether or not we're alone in the universe. But making that realization about two things, the transition from non-living to living is about information taking control, and that the origins of life, that transition, is thermodynamically favored because, as I've said over and over again, it speeds up entropy. It increases entropy in the universe, right? And it makes me, like, either terrified or excited that, you know, civilization could be potentially favored in the universe. I never thought that the evolution of, like, intelligent beings or advanced civilizations would in any way be favored in the universe. I always thought that if they occurred, it was through more or less a drunkard's walk of just random evolution leading to that, not that evolution is pushed along by the laws of thermodynamics favoring the increase in complexity leading to these advanced civilizations. Okay, I would love to hear what you think. So hit me up on Tom SciCast and let me hear your thoughts on this, right? Because this is really challenging much of the way I was taught to think about biology. And it came from the physicist. See, we learn from each other. Now, my next goal is to get the physicist to quit saying that we have no idea what life would look like. It would look like nothing on Earth. And, you know, from studying physiology, or at least teaching physiology, I'm not so sure I agree with some of those statements. So that sounds like some more podcasts coming up in the future. Well, I hope I gave you something to think about. Whether you agree or disagree, that's fine. Or the idea is maybe we start thinking about things a little bit differently. So until next time, this has been Tom SciCast.